Summary of Science and Health's ninth chapter, Creation, made with the group of students in London following the study of this chapter. Gordon Brown, March 1974.
This beautiful, spiritually tremendous ninth chapter, Creation. It's so infinitely profound that really all the human mind can do is just to step on one side and let the divine mind, the real mind of man, his God mind, our true Christ mind, just voice itself in terms of its own inspired text, in other words, really letting creation itself speak. I mean, that's what we want, isn't it? That's the subject of this chapter. And all we're asking, all we're praying for, is to let creation, or to hear creation itself speak. Now, it seems to me, and I think we've all felt this quite a bit during the study of this chapter, that we have reached, in the course of the book as a whole, at this point of the ninth chapter, we've really reached a most momentous spiritual point. It's a sort of watershed in the range of the 16 chapters. The 16 chapters constituting the four-square nature of the textbook, where they represent the city four-square, where they constitute the textbook in its what we call matrix structure, and where, therefore, educationally, what it becomes to us is, in Paul's own words, the mother of us all. It's a great feeling at once of true spiritual education when it's put like that. Now, this ninth chapter, is this the reason that it feels so momentous to us? That it comes, you see, exactly halfway through this full range of the 16 chapters. If we thought of them through a musical term, for example, the octave, the book, the 16, are composed of these two spiritual octaves, aren't they? And the ninth opens the second octave, which then ranges from creation through to the end of the apocalypse. But the only way to reach that is through the first octave, the first eight chapters from prayer to footsteps of truth. And it's just as if, I don't know whether you agree with this, do you feel this, that when we are making our journey through the book as a whole, from prayer to the apocalypse, it's as if the first eight chapters have the accent more on the objective sense. But then when we turn at this point of the ninth chapter, you get a much more subjective feeling, I think. And I'm reminded, and this is the way I would put it myself, I'm reminded of that to which the ninth chapter refers so definitely, namely the book of Job in the Old Testament. Because it seems to me that the first eight chapters are really Job saying, or our saying as Job, I have heard of thee through the hearing of the ear, through the first eight chapters. But now at the point of the ninth, as that comes through to the apocalypse, now mine eye seeth thee. I think it's something like that. Well, Inasmuch as this ninth chapter is so short, think of it, only 12 pages of it, compared with the very much longer Footsteps of Truth that precede it and the even much longer still Science of Being that comes after it. Do you think this might be a good opportunity to feel our way as gently and simply as ever we can into the perspective of the book as a whole, but with particular emphasis, of course, on the chapters that we've already covered up to this point, and including this ninth chapter, but even perhaps glancing forward to the end of the apocalypse? Would it be a nice thing if we could just get the feeling of the total setting wherein this watershed chapter, which concerns us just at this moment, finds its place? From prayer to the apocalypse. Let's just go over the titles even. And as we just think about the titles, feel the significance, the great highlights that appear in the range. It all starts with prayer, doesn't it? The first chapter, prayer, then opening out into atonement and Eucharist. That's the beginning of it all. Prayer opening out into atonement and Eucharist. Then marriage, Christian Science versus spiritualism, animal magnetism unmasked, science, theology, medicine, physiology. The first seven chapters, then it is as if they're all summed up in this great eighth chapter, Footsteps of Truth. Those really were the footsteps of truth, but it requires then, like the eighth note in the octave in music, to gather all that up and find it consummated in the eighth note or the eighth chapter. So the first octave there comes to a close, and we open out into the second with creation. Creation leading out into science of being. From the standpoint of the science of being, all the world's objections to Christian Science, all the world's objections to its own true identity as Christian Science are answered. And as soon as the world feels its own true selfhood in terms of Christian Science, or you and I feel that, then we enter the realm of Christian Science practice. 12th chapter, and that is the criterion for teaching Christian Science, 13th chapter. And then what is it that is taught? We come to the 14th chapter, recapitulation. The whole thing is there recapitulated in the 14th chapter. Then the two great final chapters of the four square structure, where the key to the scriptures, where science and health is focused as the key to the scriptures in the two tremendous chapters, Genesis and the Apocalypse. There, the four square structure comes to a close. The key is opened in the lock. The door is open. We look right out into the Bible as a whole, representing the Word of God, representing the universe, the very universe itself, and we see the translation of it out of historical, literal, material terms that look like persons, places, things, into idea, into the very Word itself. And from that standpoint, then fruitage flows naturally, spontaneously, inevitably. So There is the range of the Christian Science textbook. And we'll just, for a few minutes, before we look in more detail or try to summarize the contents of the ninth chapter, Creation, we'll just think our way through particularly these first eight chapters as they lead to the ninth. It all starts with prayer, doesn't it? And we are bidden not to think of prayer as some activity of the human mind trying to get into communion with the infinite. No, the text tells us that really our prayer, this deep, heartfelt prayer which we are feeling at this moment, which is said to be desire. Desire is prayer. This longing, this desire, which we are feeling at this moment, is divinely instigated. It really has its impulsion. Its impulsion stems from the divine mind and is not really a thing of the human mind. Nevertheless, we experience this desire. The desire for what? Well, the desire for God, the desire to be at one with God, the desire to be what in fact we are. And it takes the full range of the Christian Science textbook from prayer to the apocalypse to satisfy that desire, to answer that initial fundamental prayer. Because it's not until we reach the end of the apocalypse and we come to the 23rd Psalm, as we know there, that it says, divine love is there our shepherd, and we no longer want. What we've really prayed for, what we've really desired, is that there shan't be any desire. And at the close of the apocalypse, ideally, there isn't. There we are. Man is what he is. And there's no longer any want. As it says, he is dwelling in the house, the consciousness of love forever. It's what I am. And what I am does away with all want. So we can see the fulfillment of the initial desire or the answer to the initial prayer, which was our starting point. But that we reach in the end, when there is no longer any desire in that sense humanly, is the standpoint from which we start, because this is the way the first chapter puts it in the first three pages. That which we reach at the end, this total at-one-ment with the infinite, is the established fact of our being from the beginning. And so the first few pages are all about the fact that God's work is finished. It's already done. Mind, the true mind of man, already comprehends all. Love has already bestowed all good from the beginning. And not only so, but all good has been accepted and received from the beginning. This is what we desire, and it is our starting point from the beginning. See, if we didn't start with that truth from the beginning, we'd never be able to work through chapter by chapter from beginning to end, and in the end, experience it, find it to be the fact, if that were not the fact from the beginning, we would never find it to be the fact at the end. So there is the range from prayer to the apocalypse like that. Now, this marvelous fundamental thought and idea that it's all finished now. We are what we are from everlasting to everlasting. God's work is finished. The tone there within the matrix structure of the textbook is the word as the word. It's just the fact of being in that way. But this is not some abstract, beautiful, idealistic doctrine. And we see that as soon as we merge from the first chapter into the second, into Atonement and Eucharist, because in Atonement and Eucharist, we see that that which the first chapter states as the fact, through the tone of the word as the word, requires to come forward into the word as the Christ, because then it is, we see, it's not just the fact, it's already been proved to be the fact. From everlasting to everlasting, it's the fact that has proved itself. It's self-proving. And when we see it to be self-proving, what we're looking at, of course, is the mission of Christ Jesus, the subject of the second chapter. The second chapter has proved from everlasting to everlasting, this is the fact. And therefore, what it is that we desire in the first chapter is what is signified by the second. Indeed, it is. The subject of the second chapter, Atonement and Eucharist, is this basic idea that everything in the universe from everlasting to everlasting is at one with everything else. The at-one-ment of all things with all things constituting the one thing that is universe. Everything that exists having part, as the text says, in the at-one-ment with truth and love. And that's why this glorious combination of terms, truth and love, dominates the second chapter. This is what we long for, this is what we pray for, this is the object of our desire, this total at-one-ment of everything with everything, constituting truth and love. The wholeness of all things in truth. Nothing can depart from anything else within the wholeness of the universe as truth. But that truth must be seen to be love, because then love is that which holds and maintains the wholeness of everything in truth. Now this is being that Jesus proved to be the truth of everything. Now the great need is that this that the second chapter tells you is the fact shall become the fact for each one of us, not just the fact for Jesus. Jesus proved it to be the fact for all mankind, but the necessity is that it shall be the fact for all mankind, that mankind shall understand it and experience it. And of course that requires that the science of it shall be revealed. In other words, that what is called the first messianic advent shall lead to the second messianic advent. Now in the range of the chapters as a whole, the first messianic advent is represented by the second chapter, and the second messianic advent is represented by the sixth chapter, isn't it? Science, theology, medicine, because there it says, in the year 1866, I discovered the Christ science, or Christian Science, which is the science of the second chapter, making that standpoint available to us all. But it can't happen, it can't come into our experience unless and until chapters 3, 4, and 5 are encompassed, are complied with. I'd just like to read you the way that Paul, our beloved Paul, puts it. In 2 Thessalonians, he's looking forward to the second advent that in the range of the chapters would be chapter 6. And he puts it this way. He says, that day shall not come except there come a falling away first, and that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition, who opposeth and exalteth himself above all that is called God, whom the Lord shall consume with the spirit of his mouth. When the word is declaring itself spiritually, then the man of sin or lawlessness, the son of perdition, is consumed. It isn't man at all, of course. It's what is called in Christian Science animal magnetism. And it is that unless and until the myth, the supposition of animal magnetism is unmasked in your and my experience through chapters 3, 4, and 5 by the principle elucidated in chapter 2 for which we long in chapter 1. Until that happens, then what is signified by chapter 6, namely the spontaneous revelation of truth itself in the consciousness of each one of us, can't come until that unmasking takes place. And so the purpose of chapters 3, 4, and 5 is to unmask what is called animal magnetism. What is animal magnetism? Animal magnetism is the supposition that what is declared to be true in the first chapter, what is proved to be true in the second chapter, isn't so. Namely, the at-one-ment of everything in the universe with everything else. Animal magnetism is the supposition that man has fallen away from God. That being as spirit has been broken up into matter fragments. That's the first claim of animal magnetism. And there's a corollary to that immediately, because the second claim is that those fragments then try to join themselves together again in order to get back into unity so that the whole thing gets back into God again. All animal magnetism, because you see, none of it's ever happened. There never was a fall, there never was a breakaway necessitating a restoration or a return. So these three chapters. The supposition of animal magnetism that man has been attracted away from God, magnetized, hypnotized, away from his true mind, lost his true mind, come adrift. The corollary to that, of course, is that man himself, who is now mortal man, breaks up into a male and a female. And the first thing that happens in animal magnetism is that this male and female seek to join themselves together again in order to become a self-propagating mortal body. They think they're going to offset death by creating more mortality. But of course, it isn't so at all. But this is the first proposition of animal magnetism. And therefore, this second chapter, Atonement and Eucharist, begins to go into your and my experience in the third chapter, and therefore the tone of it turns to Christianity, the word as Christianity, it begins to go into our experience, begins to prove itself, and to disabuse our thought of this fundamental belief of breakup. When it has, in the measure that it does that, and shows us that it is the second chapter that you see the true idea of marriage. What God has joined together is everything in the universe. We are all joined to each other because we are all joined to the one being in the one universe. And that is it which animal magnetism cannot rend asunder. This begins to dawn upon us. We begin to realize this at the point of the third chapter, and the belief in animal magnetism begins to dissolve. The child asks his parent, it says at the end of the third chapter, the marriage chapter, do you have one God and creator, or is man a creator? If the father replies, God creates man through man, the child may ask, do you teach that spirit creates materially? Or do you declare that spirit is infinite and therefore matter is out of the question? Because this child, in that case, asking those questions, is really virtually saying to the parent, because if you do, you are really working in the field of spiritualism. Because at that point, the door is open to the fourth chapter, Christian Science versus Spiritualism, where man is virtually trying to get back into communion with spirit itself. See, the whole proposition is that there's an outside to spirit. What Jesus proves in the second chapter is that there's no outside to being. We live, move, and have our being in the mind, which is spirit. There's no outside. This belief of an outside is animal magnetism. It begins to be handled in that way in the third chapter, marriage, and then on into the fourth chapter, Christian Science versus Spiritualism, because there it is that this which stands on the outside of spirit, namely mortal man, a material personality, believes that he is the medium, can become a medium for spirit, and that spirit can speak through mortal man as a medium, that the infinite can bottleneck through the finite. It's all part and parcel of animal magnetism. And all this is that which masks the true nature of animal magnetism. It's the mask, which is the same word, basically, as the word, the Latin word persona. It's the belief in being a material personality that can be a medium for spirit. And so deceptive is this that it's just a mask. It's really the mask of hypocrisy. Because in the 16th chapter, the Apocalypse, animal magnetism is said to operate through two facets of itself. And one is lust, and the other is hypocrisy. And of course, hypocrisy is just a nice, pleasant mask, masking the true nature of what lies behind it. Now, the whole of animal magnetism is a mask. If you wrench off the mask, through the realization that we are not, in fact, material personalities acting as media, personal media for spirit, that spirit only speaks through itself, through its own being. And that being, the expression of it, the manifestation of it, is man in the generic sense, like the woman in the Apocalypse. Now, spirit indeed speaks through that idea of itself, but not through the mediumship of finite personalities. So, to wrench off that mask is to reveal what lies behind the mask. What lies behind the mask? Animal magnetism itself? No. What lies behind the mask is the nothingness of animal magnetism. Wrench off the mask and you reveal not animal magnetism, but the nothingness of animal magnetism. And as you reveal, not as you reveal, as that second chapter, the principle of the at-one-ment of all things in the universe with all things, as that wrenches off the mask of animal magnetism, it reveals the nothingness of animal magnetism and reveals the allness of God. And therefore it is that these first five chapters become to us God's gracious means of preparation for the standpoint of the sixth. Because in that case, here we are face to face with the infinite. The mask is off. Man is the expression on the face of God. He comes forth out of the infinite depths of divinity and is literally the expression on the face of God. I have seen thee face to face, and my life is preserved, says Jacob at the point of the sixth chapter, once the first chapter leading to the second chapter have unmasked animal magnetism through the third, fourth, and fifth chapters. Now, all that is signified by the second chapter, the first messianic advent proved by Jesus the individual, becomes available and applicable to us all. Revelation is spontaneous now. There's nothing masking it or getting in the way. So this beautiful sixth chapter, science with a capital S isn't science unless it's theology with a capital T, and theology isn't theology with a capital T unless it's medicine with a capital M. Divine science, divine theology, divine medicine. Science must be found to be the divine theos logos. That is to say, it must be God himself speaking, or else it isn't anything at all. It's just a human mind concoction. When it is the science, when it is the theos logos, and is therefore what the text calls at that point the religion of love, only when science, capital S, is the religion of love, capital L, is it medicine. Does it medicine the world? This is what it is. And so it enters, it reveals itself to the whole body of world thought, represented by science, little s, theology, old theology, mystic religion, little t, material medicine. It enters human consciousness like leaven. What does it do? What is its purpose? It is to raise the body of humanity from the dead, just as leaven enters the dead lump of dough and raises it. Therefore, in the historical picture, what do you have? You have Mary Baker Eddy, humanly the discoverer and founder of Christian Science, being raised from her deathbed. It's only a symbol, that, of the whole body of humanity, mankind, the human race, being raised from the dead. Therefore, that chapter closes on the note that if you and I should appear to die, we should not be dead. And death is in fact, it says, therefore, swallowed up in victory. The fantastic proposition is revealed of what through this sixth chapter? Of spiritual translation in place of material death. That's the purpose of it. So that what Jesus did in the second chapter can be true for each one of us at the beginning, at the point of the sixth. Now, translation is the great note that is struck then in the sixth chapter, and it comes on page 115, 116, in the form of those two translations, the translation from God to men, to humanity, bringing about the translation of humanity out of apparent mortality into immortality. That comes in the first section of the sixth chapter, the science section. In the theology section, the same thing is presented, but it's presented as a rock, as the very rock Christ, as the Petros, that which is discerned by Peter, and it's the rock upon which we all can build. It's the rock of the possibilities of spiritual translation instead of material death. Now, the wonderful thing is that exactly the same thing is brought to a focus in the third part of the sixth chapter, in the medicine part, where it appears in this form as the reduction of divine metaphysics to a system that all the world can comprehend. Translation, not death, a rock upon which to build, the appearing of the divine system that is the healing system that Jesus in the second chapter understood and demonstrated. Right? As we look into this system that is specified at that point, what do we see? We see everything in its right place. We see that nothing is ever broken away from anything else. We see the very thing that Jesus the individual proved at the point in the textbook of the second chapter. This is it, which medicines the whole world and raises it from the dead, from the deadness of this belief in breakup, which is just basic mortality. Now it's perfectly clear, isn't it, that the accent with the sixth chapter being in this way on spiritual translation, it's divine revelation taking place. Whence came to me this revelation? It comes from God, it's the gift of God. And therefore, the accent with the sixth chapter is on the first of those two translations. The revelation of what God is, therefore of what man is, therefore of what the great world body truly is. That requires that we come to the seventh chapter, physiology, where the accent goes over onto the second of the two translations, because the revelation of what body truly is takes hold of the physiological concept of either individual or world body and translates it out of that concept into the Christ body, into what we truly are as man. And therefore, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil is translated out of being a tree of the knowledge of good and evil into the tree of life. And the chapter physiology is to human sense, therefore, where man regains his paradise, which he seems to have lost. He seems to have lost his control over the body. Why does he seem to have lost his control over the body? Because he seems to have broken away from God and to have a mind of his own and a body of his own and a will of his own and a life of his own. That's why. Now the revelation of Christian Science in the sixth chapter is that that's not true. Man's mind is his God mind. And man's body is the Christ or the God body. And God has never, God mind, has never lost control of its own God body. And therefore, as this is revealed, as this comes into human experience in the seventh chapter, so humanly speaking, it is as if we are regaining our paradise, but it's the regaining in the sense that it's the awakening to the fact that it was never lost. And the chapter closes on this note, where a crucified humanity leads to a glorified humanity. It's the crucified sense, the tree of the knowledge, the accursed tree, the tree of death, translated into the tree of life, the glorified sense. Well, now, all those seven chapters are really the footsteps of truth. And they then come forward into the eighth chapter, which is then called Footsteps of Truth Itself. We've got a new beginning, a new foundation. Old things are passed away, and all things are become new. Everything is out from the infinite, not trying to get back into the infinite. Everything coming from the infinite, returning to the infinite. Our human footsteps are truth's own divine footsteps. Those are the human footsteps that we're taking. Truth's own divine footsteps as they reveal themselves humanly. Yes? Glorious, you see. Translation. All the material theories, the paraphernalia of speculative theories, says the chapter, is all translated back, swallowed up in the infinite calculus of spirit. Freedom, freedom, freedom. Freedom for the individual, freedom for the world, citizens of the world, be free. Coming up out of Egypt, through the wilderness, into the promised land, this is what this eighth chapter is about. And this freedom goes on until the climax of the eighth chapter. It's at that point, as the eighth chapter comes to a close, it's just as if we can say, begin to say, as we shall say, and as we do say in the ninth chapter, I have heard of thee by the hearing of the ear. I've heard of thee, but now I hear thee. It's no longer a matter of hearing of thee, being told about thee, as it seems to have been up to this point. As the eighth chapter closes, I hear thee. For the first time in the text, you hear God. The text is represented in this way. You hear God saying, I am. I am mind, I am spirit, I am soul, I am life, I am truth, I am love. In fact, I am, and it's the only place in the book that it comes, infinity itself with a capital I. Everything belongs to me. You, man, are my man. You are my own expression of myself. I, the Godhead, am expressed in you, the God body. And we are one, and never again can it be thought that we are separate. This is what Jesus proved at the second chapter. The lie about which fell away through chapters 3, 4, and 5 until you began to see it and have it revealed, the point of chapter 6, translating the physiological concept, all gathered up in chapter 8 until you come to this point where it is indeed God himself
speaking, the Theos Logos, God himself speaking, I am, I am, I am. But we haven't yet entered the ninth chapter. And therefore, something else wonderful happens on the last page of the eighth chapter, and it is the statement that, in fact, Christian Science is absolute. We read there that during the sensual ages, absolute Christian Science may not be achieved prior to the change called death, for we haven't got the power to demonstrate what we don't understand. And therefore, the chapter itself at the very end closes on this same note of the cross leading to the crown. Just as in the seventh chapter, it was a crucified Jesus leading to a glorified Jesus. See that? But the door is wide open. It may not be achieved. Therefore, it may be. And if it may be, then we must be told how it may be. And we are told how it may be from chapter 9 onwards. See, cross leading to crown, or crucifixion leading to glorification, is out of death into resurrection. It's dying out of one world into another world. Supposedly, now, the answer to that must appear. Because if we can begin to understand and therefore to demonstrate that Christian Science is in fact absolute, that in the case of Jesus operating from the standpoint of divine science through the reduction of divine science to this system that is Christian Science could not ever be anything other than absolute. Inasmuch as this absoluteness begins to act upon the evidence before the material senses, it begins to dispose, step by step, through the footsteps of truth, of all belief that Christian Science is in fact other than absolute, that there is something outside of it to which it must apply itself, which it has to destroy, so that it has to heal this and heal that and heal the other. But in fact, Christian Science, all the way along through the footsteps of truth, is proving itself to be absolute step by step, until at the point of the overcoming of what is called the last enemy, death, it proves itself absolutely to be absolute. And when that happens, then the term absolute Christian Science is given. But that doesn't mean to say that Christian Science has not been absolute all the way along. So, absolute Christian Science is related to the resurrection, is it not? But the only reason that Jesus could accomplish the resurrection was because of the standpoint which it seems to me, and I think we felt it when we studied it, the standpoint of the ninth chapter. We felt it, and we felt it, and we felt it, but it didn't really state itself until we came to the very last paragraph of the ninth chapter, and there it was referred to. So before we begin at the beginning of the ninth chapter, the first page, let's turn to the last page, page 267, and right into the last paragraph. Take the sentence, beginning line 25, which is about the robes of spirit being white and glistering like the raiment of Christ. And it goes on,
Even in this world, therefore, let thy garments be always white. Don't wait for a next world. Here, not hereafter. In this world, therefore, let thy garments be always white, because really and truly there isn't one world here to die out of and another world there to die into. Even in this world, therefore, let thy garments be always white. Have on the robes of spirit, which are white and glistering like the raiment of Christ. What are the robes of spirit? We had it in the previous chapter, the divine science of man woven into one web of consistency without seam or rent. It's what Jesus proved regarding the universe at the point of the second chapter. That there's no breakup. The total at-one-ment of everything with everything. Those are the robes with which we are clothed, must find ourselves clothed, which are white and glistering like the raiment of Christ. And what is being referred to? What is it a direct reference to? The transfiguration. Is it not? The transfiguration. And we do well just to turn. I'll read it, because I've got it written down here. Luke chapter 9, where it says that he was transfigured before them. Now, to transfigure is to change the form. We know how this chapter is all about form. It never stops, scarcely, throughout, talking about form. Is that right? To change the form in appearance or character, to idealize, and the word figure is the same as the word form. He was transfigured before them. And this is how it goes. And here you can see that it's the standpoint that in fact absolute Christian science can be achieved prior to the change called death. That we do not have to go through the so-called change called death in order to be changed, in order to be transfigured. Because this is how the gospel puts it. Jesus says, I tell you of a truth, there be some standing here which shall not taste of death. Not crucifixion leading to resurrection. No. And it came to pass about an 8 days after, well, 8 days, we've had 8 chapters. This is the 9th chapter. The other Gospels say 6 days, but Luke says 8 days. And we've certainly encompassed 8 chapters. 8 days after these sayings, he took Peter, John, and James and went up into a mountain to pray. And as he prayed, the fashion of his countenance was altered. It's the changed form, you see. And his raiment was white and glistering. He was clothed with this understanding of the absolute, of absolute Christian science. The absolute unity of being. And behold, there talked with him Moses and Elias, who appeared in glory, and spake of his decease, which he should accomplish at Jerusalem. See, with Jesus, he must show this transfiguration first, because he has to prove the nothingness of death second, and then that will lead to resurrection third. So that the identity is between resurrection and transfiguration. But in Christian science, transfiguration does away with the necessity for death, crucifixion, that then leading to resurrection. Transfiguration does away with it. And so it says how
Peter said unto Jesus, let us make three tabernacles, one for thee, one for Moses, one for Elias, not knowing what he said. Didn't know what he was talking about. While he spake, there came a cloud. I'm not surprised. There came a cloud and overshadowed them, and a voice came out of the cloud saying, this is my beloved Son. Hear him. To Peter, you see, Moses was the past, Jesus was the present, and Elias the future. Three tabernacles. No, that's not my beloved Son. My beloved Son is man. Man in the form of the Son of God, wherein the whole of being is contemporaneous with everything else. No past, no present, no future in terms of time, but the contemporaneity of eternity and of infinity now. That transfigures the human. And the form is no longer the form of mortality, but the form of immortality. Now, we could scarcely, those of us who have any sense of are acquainted with the prose writings, couldn't fail to remember this, could they? Where Mrs. Eddy is talking about translation in Miscellaneous Writings, page 67. And she puts it in this way. It isn't the way, perhaps, that you and I would put it, but this is how it says it there. It speaks of the removal of a person to heaven without his subjection to death is possible after all the footsteps. And here we are at the point of the ninth chapter creation that has been preceded by the eighth chapter footsteps of truth. Is possible after all the footsteps have been taken up to the very throne. How does this ninth chapter start? What is the verse of the Bible on which it is founded? Thy throne, it's the throne of grace itself, you see. Thy throne is established of old, thou art from everlasting. All the footsteps have been taken up to the very throne, and this must include man's changed appearance. You see, the fashion of his countenance was altered. Man's changed appearance and diviner form, figure form, transfigure, change the form in appearance or character. Man's changed appearance and diviner form visible to those beholding him here. What a proposition! But as the ninth chapter closes, the very end of the final paragraph, we're told the simple answer, how to achieve it. And it quotes from James, blessed is the man that overcometh temptation. For when he is proved faithful, he shall receive the crown of life, which the Lord hath promised to them that love him. See, the crown is there. The crown is here at the end of the ninth chapter. The crown was there at the end of the eighth chapter. The crown was there at the end of the seventh chapter. But this time, not preceded by death. As we can prove that we are faithful in the matter of overcoming temptation, this is the answer. Then we receive the crown of life itself. What is this business of overcoming temptation? What is temptation? Well, just look up the page to line 15, 16. Jesus said, whosoever shall do the will of my Father which is in heaven, the same as my brother and sister and mother. The temptation to have a will of one's own, a mind of one's own, an ego of one's own, an I, a life, an intelligence, a brain, a heart, a body, and anything of one's own. Whereas, in fact, says this chapter, I am the Godhead and you are the God body. Don't have anything, don't be tempted, you see. And therefore, this is the answer in terms of transfiguration as against crucifixion followed by resurrection. It's resurrection, but without the death proposition. Absolute Christian science may be achieved, therefore, prior to the change called death. And we can now, I think, realizing that this is what the chapter is about, we can then start at the beginning of the chapter and feel this to be true as our thought flows throughout these 12 pages of the chapter. Let's just leave it at that for the moment then, and then we'll begin on page 255.
Please now turn the tape over.